a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. A chilly day in the upper Midwest. Boy, fall has hit us full force. In the 40s in many areas, the 30s in some other areas. I don't think Duluth is going to make it above 40 degrees today. It is definitely headed towards winter, and hopefully not an early winter, because those of us who live in this part of the country know that winter can be pretty severe, and so we're hoping that this is not a foretaste of things to come. But don't you love the fall colors? That's one of the things that is just so wonderful about this time of year in the upper Midwest, is enjoying the change in seasons. And if you live in an area where you've got a nice display of foliage right now, enjoy, take some photos, get your kids out in the leaves in the pumpkin patch, and maybe go apple picking. Is it too late to go apple picking? No, you can still go apple picking right now, I think, in a lot of orchards. We're going to be talking about a fascinating topic this hour, and that's apologetics, Christian apologetics. How do we defend our faith? How do we, in a rational, persuasive, winsome way, convince our friends, work associates, extended family members that Christianity is true? And we'll be talking to an author who's written a great new book on that topic in just a bit. First, though, I thought we'd take a look at a few of the culture and faith-related stories in the news this week. There's a nonstop worship service going on the Ellipse, the grassy park just south of the White House. A large tent is erected over folding chairs and a stage where musicians are leading hymns and prayer around the clock until Election Day. The director of this event, it's called David's Tent DC, Jason Hershey, says it's modeled after the worship King David established when he reigned in Jerusalem. Hershey says this isn't a political event, despite the time and place. Father Dean Schultz, a charismatic Episcopal priest, says it's a blessing that Americans are able to gather for worship outside the house where their president lives. Well, Pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church in Southern California has been released from the hospital. The pastor of this huge mega church experiencing pain in his arms and numbness in his fingers last week. He underwent a series of tests to determine what the cause is, although doctors think that he may have an inner ear virus that spread to the nerves in his neck and down his arms. They're doing more tests, but for now they say Reverend Warren is good to go. So keep your prayers, keep Rick Warren in your prayers, a man who I've met before and has done some amazing work in Southern California in both spreading the gospel and serving his community and the communities all throughout Orange County, California, and Los Angeles County, my old stomping grounds. And so be praying for Pastor Rick Warren. Well, a state lawmaker who operates an Arkansas preschool says students will begin singing a prayer in order to get around a rule banning religious activity at state-funded preschools. Others disagree with the interpretation that the Growing God's Kingdom preschool can skirt this rule through song. The rule defines prayer as a religious activity, but allows religious music under certain circumstances. So this ruling goes into effect on October 26th, and of course the big controversy is separation of church and state, because this preschool receives state funding. So should the kids be allowed to sing prayers rather than recite them? That's one of those jot and tittle issues that we maybe see Jesus talking about in the New Testament. In other news, an Ohio I love this story. An Ohio church has drawn a standing room crowd for the dedication of a roadside Jesus statue that replaces one destroyed 2 years ago in a lightning fire. The Dayton Daily News reports that the Solid Rock Church in Monroe, north of Cincinnati, dedicated the 51-foot statue at a service last Sunday night. The statue is nicknamed Hug Me Jesus because the lighted statue depicts a full-bodied Jesus who's standing with open arms looming over the adjacent lanes of Interstate 75 near Cincinnati. The previous statue was ruined by lightning in the year 2010. It was nicknamed Touchdown Jesus because it depicted Jesus from the waist up with his arms uplifted to heaven. Now, this might seem like a humorous story to you, but in effect, you think about hundreds of thousands of people probably drive on this particular interstate, Interstate 75, through Ohio every year, and many of them are not believers. And at the very least, you know, they look over, and it's kind of hard to miss Jesus reaching out to them when he's 51 feet tall, looming over the freeway. Perhaps that will cause them to take more interest in the gospel and maybe even crack open a Bible for the first time. On the other hand, maybe they just maybe see it as a joke. I don't know. I don't know how the average non-believer would interpret this statue, but the church is obviously excited about it and sees it as a potential outreach and was willing to spend the time and effort in rebuilding this. I saw photographs. If you Google this this story, you just put in Jesus Statue, Ohio, you can see photos of the original sculpture, which, again, was struck by lightning in 2010. I don't want to make a theological assumption about that, but, you know, whether God wanted them to rebuild it. But it's interesting, there are some pictures of the original statue going up in flames back in 2010, and they've been so concerned about this now for the last 2 years, and they really wanted to rebuild it. And as we said, this particular statue is Jesus with his arms reaching out to those on the freeway in love. And I think personally that's pretty cool, pretty exciting. I'm Bill Meyer, and you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to an author who has written a wonderful introduction and overview of apologetics, defending the faith. So stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
I want to say a word or two today about an increasingly common condition known as fetal alcohol syndrome. Now, the fetus can be damaged by alcohol throughout the entire 9 months gestation, but he or she is especially vulnerable in the first trimester of development. Alcohol in the blood of the mother at that time can produce devastating problems, including heart anomalies, central nervous system dysfunction, head and facial abnormalities, and lifelong behavior problems. And tragically, fetal alcohol syndrome is also thought to be the leading cause of mental retardation. You may remember the story of Samson in the Old Testament, who terrorized his enemies, the Philistines. Before he was born, his mother was told by an angel that her child was destined for greatness and that she must not weaken him by imbibing strong drink while she was pregnant. Well, medical science has now verified the wisdom of that advice. That's why a similar warning to pregnant women is posted by law wherever liquor, beer, and wine are sold. If you're pregnant or if you anticipate becoming pregnant, don't take chances with your baby's future. There is no level of alcohol that's known to be safe. Abstain for the entire 9 months. You and your baby will be so glad you did.
There's more Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson at MyFamilyTalk.com. That's MyFamilyTalk.com.
Now back to more Faith and Culture Connection with Dr. Bill Meyer.
And welcome back. It's the lunch hour in the Upper Midwest, 12 minutes past noon. Our phone number, 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. If you want to connect with us, if you have any questions for our guest. And our guest this hour is Chris Sinkinson. Chris worked as an archaeologist before studying philosophy and theology. He is now a lecturer in apologetics at Moorlands College on the south coast of England. He pastors a church in New Forest, England, and today he joins us to talk about his new book, Christian Confidence. And Chris, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we talk about your new book, can you tell us a bit about your church there in New Forest and about your own family?
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Well, I'm married to my wife, obviously, Roz, and we have two boys, Thomas and Toby, 11-year-old and 7-year-old, going on 13. You know, they're growing up.
I understand.
And yeah, they're lovely kids. And I've been pastor of the church here for 12 years. So over that time, my children have grown up here, and it's lovely to be part of a church where it's their family, it's their peer group, and it's such a hub for all that we do. It's a church of about 120. You know, it's okay by English standards. I guess it may be a little small compared to some standards, but it's been a growing church. 12, 14 years ago, I think the membership was somewhere down around 11. So it's grown pretty significantly the last few years.
Can you describe the community of New Forest for us? Many Americans love England, have traveled there before, and some have not. But give us a kind of a paint a picture, a postcard picture of what New Forest is like.
Sure. Well, we're in a semi-rural area in between Salisbury and Bournemouth. We're about a two-hour drive from London. And the New Forest is one of the large national parks in England. And so it's an extensive area of forest. It's called the New Forest because it was planted 1,000 years ago by William the Conqueror. So when he came over from France and took over England, he decided to have his own royal hunting forest. So he planted a forest. It was called the New Forest, and 1,000 years on, we're still calling it the New Forest today. It's a beautiful area. We have ponies roaming around on the roads. You know, the ponies are just they range free, and lots of other deer and other wildlife around. Nothing particularly dangerous. We have some poisonous snakes, but that's about as dangerous as it gets.
And, it sounds beautiful.
It is. It is. Now, I mean, we're also, you know, got a fair population. I mean, England is pretty small, of course, so people would live where I am, but work perhaps in one of the big cities, Southampton, Salisbury, Bournemouth, which is a pretty easy drive from here. Some would even work as far as London, which, as I say, is a couple of hours away.
Now, can you tell us about the current state of Christianity in Great Britain? Let's just look at give us maybe a 30,000-foot level of where the faith is currently.
Sure. You know, Charles Dickens, when he opens the novel Tale of Two Cities, describes it as the best of times and the worst of times. And I think you could read this either way. So let me give you the kind of pessimistic view first, and then I'll give you the more positive view. So pessimistically, Christianity has been in enormous decline throughout the UK, and the statistics are really significant that each year there is significant decline. So right now, average church going on a Sunday, we're looking at about 4.5% of the population. And that's down even about 10 years ago from 6% of the population. So it's constant decline, down to about 4.5% church going in the UK. Now, you can get a slightly bigger figure. I mean, you know, the figures get massaged in different ways. And you can get a slightly higher figure by looking at monthly church going or special events like Easter, Christmas, a royal wedding, you know, something like that. But the bottom line is around about 4.5%. And that's a significant downhill ski slope, really, when you look at the graphs. Now, that then has a cash value, of course, in terms of culture, the media, politics. So in each of these areas, I think particularly we've noticed it the last 10 to 15 years, Christianity being squeezed to the margins. And we see that on the media, where if a religion is going to be joked about, it'll be Christianity. You don't hear many jokes leveled at other religions, but certainly Christianity will be joked about. Doesn't get much serious airtime. And then, of course, in schools, there's a pretty constant battle, really, to maintain a Christian presence and Christian values. Now, that's probably a pessimistic picture, but nonetheless, the statistics bear it out. More positively, you could say that what's happening certainly in England, I think this covers most of the UK, but certainly in England, more positively, there is a kind of sharpening up of what the church really is. If people go to church, they're likely to be born-again believers. They're likely to believe the Bible is the Word of God. There's a falling away of nominal Christianity. And we see it in the figures again, where mainline denominations that have perhaps been particularly liberal in their approach to the Bible have suffered the most rapid levels of decline. So it may be that what's happening is the church is, well, theologically, it's being refined. You know, it's being refined and perhaps if you're going to go to church, you're going to make a stand for Jesus, and you're going to have a real conviction about the place of the Bible in your life.
Now, how would England, how would that vary, let's say, from Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland?
Yeah, it's fair to say that Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland would still have a stronger Christian presence in both politics, in media, in the schools. I mean, there is a very liberal movement throughout the education system in the United Kingdom, so that's true. And, I mean, we see that in Scotland perhaps particularly. But nonetheless, the church-going figures would be a little more robust in Wales and Scotland. But the decline is there. I mean, the decline is national throughout the UK.
And what about the growth of Islam?
And Islam sees, you know, significant growth. Islam, if you believe the projections, there'll be more people in mosques in 10 years' time than in churches. But, I mean, obviously, those are based on certain assumptions. We don't know how that's going to pan out. I mean, part of the issue with Islam is that it's grown a great deal through immigration over, you know, the last 50 years. So that kind of skews the statistics somewhat. But there has been significant growth in Islam, many more mosques being built. And there are certain places in the UK where you could think you're, you know, in the Middle East. You know, I mean, it's very significant in pockets around the UK.
Now, as you talk to Christians, both in your teaching and in your own church, do Christians feel persecuted? Do they feel assailed? Do they feel like they're the butt of jokes? Or do they feel like their friends and neighbors are just more ambivalent, really could care less about their Christian beliefs?
Well, I think many Christians have experienced the growing ferocity, actually, in the kind of persecution. Now, this isn't, you know, a matter of going to prison or physical violence. This is not the kind of persecution that I mean to be referring to. But there have been many examples now of legal issues that have come up where Christians just going about their normal lives of witness and their normal beliefs have been in trouble with the police or in trouble in the law courts, what they've done. So let me give you one example just from a year or so ago, where a Christian coffee shop, it was run by a local church, but it was a public coffee shop, played on a screen in the coffee shop a set of DVDs which had Bible verses. So these were appearing with the sound turned down. The verses were appearing. It was the whole of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation appearing on a screen in the coffee shop. Now, they had a visit from the police, and they were told that this was in breach of a Public Order Act. There was an issue of a complaint that had been made that these verses contained homophobic material. And so the police were threatening, and they were told that they couldn't use these materials in the coffee shop. Now, subsequently, that went to legal action, and the police had to apologize. They had to admit that they had been overzealous in their interpretation of the law. And so after legal action, they backed down. But, of course, it's an indication of the kind of growing level of threat that many Christians would feel. And, of course, if you don't have the money to do the legal action, you're more likely to just perhaps keep your head down and not want to create any trouble.
Now, I'm unfamiliar with British law. Does Britain have something equivalent to our First Amendment in your courts, in your laws, where there is the freedom of religious expression is protected?
Yes, I'm not sure. I'm no legal scholar, so I'm not sure how that's enshrined in our legislature, but that certainly is there. The real flashpoint legally right now has been the issue of homophobia, and anything that is seen as homophobic, this can be challenged legally. Now, we've also had, of course, the issue, as you've been facing as well, of same-sex marriages, and this has created a tension now in churches where if we wish to deny that possibility of a same-sex marriage, will this legally be an issue of homophobia? Will this break equality laws that we have? Right now, churches are exempt from a lot of the equality laws on this issue of homophobia and equal rights. But it's certainly a flashpoint. And, you know, at some point there's going to be, you know, a test case that will be made where, you know, we will have somebody, particularly on the homosexual rights issue, pushing a church or a Christian organization. We've certainly had adoption agencies have to close down and not able to do their work because it's legally been shown to be a problem to try and adopt children into families where the mother and father do not support homosexual behavior. So a number of Roman Catholic agencies have simply had to close down because they would not adopt children. Well, they wouldn't even question this. I mean, you know, a lot of agencies would adopt to a mum and a dad and wouldn't question what the mum and dad's views on homosexuality are. But apparently, if mothers and fathers were not supportive of homosexual lifestyles, then they're considered not suitable to adopt children. And so that's been a legal issue, and a number of test cases have had adoption agencies closed down. The irony is we now have a lot of children who need adoption, and we're just not finding the families to adopt these children, to take them in.
And we've had parallels here in the U.S. with the Catholic Social Services and the fact that in some states they've lost their charter because they won't place kids in gay households with two moms or two dads, and obviously a growing controversy both here and in your country. A great time for your book, obviously, for Christians to be able to defend their faith, to do it in a rational, logical, winsome way. What was the inspiration for your decision to write Christian Confidence?
Well, I've always felt that apologetics is an important dimension of evangelism. In the end, I think this is the nature of evangelism, that we are giving an answer back to the questions people are asking, and that we present the gospel in a winsome, credible, and effective way that addresses real issues. So I've always felt that, and I've benefited enormously from other apologists, and I mean, there are many American apologists who've just been so helpful this side of the pond. Josh McDowell and William Lane Craig, Gary Habermas, really helpful material. So why should I add something into the mix? And so grateful American IVP taking it over to you guys over there. For me, I wanted to step back a little from the sort of immediate issues that we face in apologetics and look in a more historical way at how Christians have handled reason and philosophy and debates. Because what I've been concerned with is that apologetics is not a new thing. It is always part of Christian witness and always has been. And when we think back historically over 2,000 years, I spent some time in the book looking at the history of apologetics, we discover that Christians have always had this theme of confident, robust, positive witness and engaging with the objections of the day. And we can learn a great deal from the past. We can learn a great deal from how Christians have done this in the past as we apply it to our own time.
So in a nutshell, why are apologetics so important to a Christian? My impression, Chris, and I don't know if you feel this in your country as well, but my impression is that in the American church, far too few Christians, especially evangelicals and perhaps Catholics as well, are equipped to be able to defend their faith, especially from some of the neo-atheist attacks, some of the claims made by the neo-atheists. They often feel backed into a corner. They often get defensive. We have, this, bumper sticker here. God said it, I believe it. That settles it. Well, that obviously doesn't settle it in the minds of many more aggressive atheists or agnostics. Now we have groups in this country like the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is very aggressive in trying to expunge all elements of the Christian faith out of, the public square. So I guess I would ask you, give us an explanation of why apologetics is such a key part of our life in Christ.
Well, you're absolutely right, Bill, that I believe this is a key part, but of course for many Christians it has not been a key part, and there's been perhaps a kind of attitude that if our experience of God is strong and that's what matters, it doesn't matter if we can articulate it or explain it. Some Christians have had a very sentimental view of their faith, a very sentimental view of the Bible. It's the bumper sticker mentality. And, I think the reason why this is such an issue, and we have to confront this and encourage a more robust view of Christianity, can be found from the statistics and figures again. Because, we started talking about the figures of decline. And this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. As a pastor, I'm interested in church growth. I'm interested in where the church is at today. And I always worked under the assumption that the decline of Christianity in the UK probably came about sometime around the 1960s, 1950s, because I would tie it to what we would call the sexual revolution and a period of time after the Second World War when perhaps people would stop going to church, they were indulging in the hippie movement, alternative lifestyles. And so I always assumed that the figures would show the decline in church going to be 50s and 60s. But actually, when we look at the figures, first of all, the clearest figures we've got take us back to 1900.
And when you, Chris, I'm going to have to take a quick break here. I want to develop this more because obviously the history is important. We are talking to Chris Sinkinson. He is the author of a new book called Christian Confidence from InterVarsity Press. He's been kind enough to join us all the way from England, from New Forest, England, where he pastors a church. And we're going to be developing this topic of apologetics more, looking at a history of the entire school of apologetics as a discipline, and helping you to more robustly defend your faith. Stick with us. We'll be back on the other side of this quick break here on the Faith Radio Network.
Join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Thanks so much for spending part of your Saturday with us here in the Upper Midwest on the Faith Radio Network. It's 31 past the hour. My guest, Chris Sinkinson. Chris is a lecturer in apologetics at Moorlands College on the south coast of England. He pastors a church in New Forest, England, and he worked as an archaeologist before studying philosophy and theology. And Chris has written an excellent new book on InterVarsity Press. It's called Christian Confidence. And before the break there, Chris, you were starting to develop the idea that you started looking at the decline of Christianity in your country. You thought, well, perhaps it was the sexual revolution of the 1960s, kind of the rebellion against authority. But then as you looked a little deeper, you found that, no, perhaps Christianity started to wane even earlier than that.
That's right. That's right. And the figures that I had went back to 1900. Those are the clearest figures, which show this downhill ski run of a church in decline. But then there are figures that go back earlier than that. They're not as full. They're not as complete. But they do help us to locate when church going peaked in the UK. And the peak of church going in the UK is around 1850, about 1851. After then, it's downhill. A little later for the free churches, but for mainstream churches, it's really the middle of the 1800s that church going goes into decline. And then I ask myself, well, what else is going on in the middle of the 1800s? You know, what else is happening culturally? It's the same decade as the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of the Species, which may be interesting. And it reflects a period when a liberal view of the Bible had already become the accepted norm in seminaries and colleges. There was a shift away from biblical Christianity at the intellectual level in the early 1800s. We call it the Enlightenment period. And that had happened at the intellectual level, and then within a generation, we find church going into decline. It's interesting, if we just take Charles Darwin as an example for a moment. On the Origin of the Species, if you know, your listeners have had a go at reading that, it's not the most gripping book if you're not a specialist or not interested in the biology so much. But a book of his which is very interesting to my mind from a theological point of view is his autobiography. And in his autobiography, Charles Darwin describes why he lost his faith in God. And it actually isn't related to the publication of On the Origin of the Species. It's much earlier than that. And he describes how in the 1820s already he cannot believe the Bible is a reliable book, full of contradictions, he thinks. He can't believe Christianity is the only one religion. He speaks of the Hindus and Muslims also having, you know, equal insights. And also he can't believe in a good God with the existence of suffering. And he himself would experience the loss of his 10-year-old girl a few decades later, which was seen as the kind of turning point for him. And so what you see in the life of Charles Darwin is that he departed from God intellectually quite some time before that publication of On the Origin of the Species, and it reflected the things that were being taught in academia. And as Al Walters once put it, ideas have legs. You know, if an idea takes off, it has legs and goes somewhere. And within a generation, the church started to go into decline. Now, why do I set that all up for my book? Well, you know, it inspired me to think, actually, what we really need to rediscover as Christians is a positive confidence in the truth of Christianity, not just true because it feels good or it's sentimentally very helpful, but true because it's a true description of the way things really are. There really is a God. There really is a heaven and a hell. There really is a salvation through Christ. And it was the loss of conviction in the truth of those things that I believe was the fundamental issue in the decline of interest in Christianity.
Now, give us a brief history of apologetics throughout the church, perhaps starting with the early church, and maybe, if you would, tie into the fact that in the Middle Ages, certainly, that many of the leading scientists were in science specifically for the reason to discover God's created order.
That's right. Well, okay, if we can go back to the early church, first of all, I've been interested just researching how early theologians really considered themselves apologists. They wouldn't have really made a distinction between the task of theology and the task of apologetics. So some of our earliest, we call them the church fathers, but our earliest Christian theologians like Justin Martyr and Eusebius and Augustine, of course, Tertullian, they really considered their work to be works of apologetics. And this was at a time when Christianity really was persecuted and was certainly a minority faith within the wider Roman and Greek society. Of course, Justin Martyr, the early theologian of the second century, who was also an apologist, would be beheaded for his faith, would be beheaded for apologetics, actually. I think he won a debate against the Greek philosopher and was beheaded as a result. So if we look at their work, we find that in the early church, there was a real conviction to put forward the evidences for the faith. And there are two things that really stand out in the church fathers. Number one was their commitment to the bodily resurrection of Jesus. And this comes up time and again. Not a commitment to some spiritual resurrection or an experience of a raised Jesus, but a commitment to the bodily resurrection of Jesus, that Jesus really had risen from the tomb. There was an empty tomb. And so this was one strand of the early church apologetic. And the second strand would be the evidence of fulfilled prophecy, that the Old Testament provided many different evidences and pointers that were fulfilled in the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. So apologetics was part of theology in the early church. Now, yes, when we turn to the later Middle Ages, I think we do have to recognize that the Bible has inspired so much of culture, whether it's art, science, history, writing. The commitment to truth, the commitment to research, the commitment to an orderly universe, all of this provides foundations for what is the Western world's academy. Our great institutions are based on Christian principles. I think that's particularly clear after the Reformation. After the Reformation, in the period immediately following, we have, for example, in England, the establishment of the Royal Society for the Sciences. And most of the fellows of the Royal Society were not only Christians, they were what we would consider evangelical Christians. It's not just they had some kind of deist view of God or a vague idea about prayer, but they were what we would consider Bible-believing Christians. And their convictions about a God of creation, a God who created an orderly universe, this inspired the modern scientific project.
It's fascinating when you look at that history, Chris, and yet what happened with the Enlightenment? Where did those robust thinkers go? Did a generation die off? Did those traditions get lost? Was it that the Enlightenment was such an exciting roller coaster ride that that the culture jumped on board, and that what happened to change things so dramatically in the mid 19th century?
Well, I think the key change will be our attitude to revelation. You know, for John Calvin, in the Institutes, there's a very clear commitment at the beginning to two forms of God's revelation. God has revealed himself in the natural order, the book of creation, and God has revealed himself through Scripture. So there's the book of special revelation. And this commitment would have been foundational to allowing theologians to work with the book of revelation in Scripture, scientists to work with the book of revelation in creation. But when we reach someone like René Descartes, the French philosopher, or Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, there's a very important philosophical shift, And it's a shift away from any conviction that there is a revelation that we can depend on. So famously, René Descartes, the French philosopher, in his discourse on the method of philosophy, says that the first fundamental fact that we can believe in, the foundation of all knowledge, is I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. And this was a shift to the self being the source of all knowledge. Not revelation, not a God who speaks, not a revelation in nature, but our own self. And upon that foundation, the Enlightenment would build a whole new approach to knowledge and reasoning. And what we find following is that there would be ultimately a very subjective view of knowledge based on our limited experience. And if we can't see it or touch it or experiment on it, it cannot be true. It's interesting, you know, that's where it starts with philosophers like Descartes and Kant. And then within a generation, you've got practicing scientists putting this into place. And I would include people like Charles Darwin with his agnosticism, the later Sigmund Freud in the era of psychology, Feuerbach, and many different intellectuals who are applying this in their own sphere. Karl Marx would be another example, an atheist applying this to economics. And in each area, the God of revelation has been pushed aside. Everything will be founded upon what is ultimately knowledge of self. And I think that shift happens over several decades. It happens over a period of time after the Enlightenment. But Christianity is privatized. So a scientist who is a Christian in the later 1800s may well be allowed to be a Christian, but they'll keep their Christianity out of the laboratory. They'll keep it out of their research papers. And I think, in a very interesting way, we've got this debate now back on the table with what's called the intelligent design movement. Because, of course, all the intelligent design movement is really demonstrating is that, in an objective sense, the evidence of the material universe itself points to something outside of that universe, a designer. Something beyond this universe must explain whether it's the fundamental constants of the physics of the universe or whether it's the complexity, the irreducible complexity of biology. It must be explained by something beyond this universe. There is evidence of intelligent design. And yet, look how fierce the opposition is to that from some quarters. It's almost the great blasphemy of modern science to dare to suggest that it can't all be explained by pure material processes. And that, I think, is part of the heritage of that move in the Enlightenment.
We had Dr. Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute on a few weeks ago talking about this very issue, and it is fascinating just to see how vehemently those that are committed to Darwinism, neo-Darwinists, will defend their faith, so to speak, which really is somewhat of a faith movement, certainly a worldview, and it gets very emotional at times. Let's turn to the practical aspects of apologetics for a moment, and I know your book really is more of an overview and an introduction for the average person, but where do we kind of start? And you can get into your college professor mode if you'd like here, but where does the average Christian start to build a robust, rational, logical, and winsome defense of their faith?
Yes, and I think, again, one of the themes in the book that I was keen to promote is that Christianity should be positive in its presentation of the faith. Apologetics means to give a word back. And, of course, I subtitled the book, it's the defense of the faith. It is defending our faith from critics. But that defense is a positive, putting forward the case. And I think we need to have much more of a sense of confidence that we really do have truth to share. And when we compare it to the alternatives, to the really the foundations of straw that the alternatives are built upon, we should have a much more positive view of what we have to offer. Now, in order to get going on that and to encourage Christians practically in this, I think we need to be willing to spend time reading and thinking and researching aspects of what we believe and why we believe it. And let's be enthusiastic about that. I feel I'm a natural enthusiast, so I love history and archaeology. I've been involved in an archaeological project in Bethsaida with the University of Nebraska, actually, out in Israel. And these things interest me in and of themselves. I mean, I just find it fascinating. I just love this material. I love to find out more of these things. I love to research these things, not because necessarily I'm trying to construct an argument in defense of Christianity, just because I love to find out the truth about our faith. And I think we need to encourage Christians to be enthusiastic in that, that if we all did a lot more to maybe, in your last section of the show there, to research Mormonism, think about what Mormonism is teaching, think about how that departs from Orthodox Christianity, not simply so we can construct an argument, but because then we'll understand our faith a whole lot better. Apologetics will actually help us to worship God better. We'll know God better with our mind and worship God better, heart, mind, and soul. And so I would encourage Christians to think in those terms, to have that enthusiastic desire to know more about what we believe and why we believe. I would encourage preachers to think about that in their sermons. How do our sermons not only explain, the great devotional truths and value of the Bible, but how does it also provide the reasons for why these things matter and why the alternatives fall so far short of the value of God's word, why they fall so far short in terms of their evidential value. So these would be the kinds of areas where I would encourage us practically as Christians.
It seems to me that there is a real dearth of, I don't know how to put this. I want to put this in a loving way, but it seems that in the average evangelical church in America, and certainly there are exceptions, but there is very little attention paid to the life of the mind. Many churches have wonderful worship. They have, great inspiration to serve, to become more Christ-like. All those things, of course, are very important and very valuable. But the life of the mind, to love God with all of our mind, which I believe a professor at Biola wrote a book on that particular topic a few years ago. But that is something that has gotten lost in the last few years. It's a tragedy, and unfortunately it sets many Christians up to be in situations where they're unable to defend their faith. Hugh Hewitt, a radio commentator here in the U.S., wrote a book called The Embarrassed Christian a few years back. And I think many Christians find themselves in that situation. And, okay, here's one. This is just a layperson. I'm not a theologian. I'm a psychologist, but a layperson when it comes to theology. I believe that if Americans would just turn off their televisions and devote even half the time they spend to watching television to actually reading, and then to devote part of that reading to learning more about their Christian faith, their Christian worldview, and as part of that, learning how to defend it, I think we would have a much more robust church in America, and I'm guessing you would agree.
I would certainly agree. And we have such wonderful resources now. I mean, you don't even have to turn your TV off all the time because there are great DVD resources. There are wonderful resources on the Internet if you look carefully and choose your sites carefully. And, of course, great books to be reading as well. And, again, I would just encourage Christians to be positive about this. I wanted to prepare just recently a harvest talk at our local church, and so I did a lot of research on the hummingbird, and I phoned up a professor and got information on the hummingbird, and I wanted to compare the hummingbird to the Eurofighter, which is an advanced fighter that we've built out here in Europe, and look at the technology of the hummingbird and as evidence of design, of intelligent design. And I just find this fascinating. It's part of, again, worship. I mean, I worship the God of creation all the more that I investigate these things. And this is the way I think we as Christians should encourage one another to use our minds in worship, to understand these things better.
And certainly we're challenged to, in Scripture, Peter telling us that we should always have a defense at the ready, and, of course, do that in a winsome way. And again, far too few of us do have that ability. And we find ourselves often stuck and then getting defensive or getting frustrated or even getting angry in response to, let's say, a very assertive or even aggressive agnostic or atheist. And all of us have encountered those. We're talking to Chris Sinkinson. He's the author of the book Christian Confidence, and we have some copies of Chris's book to give away. And in fact, I'd love to give these away to perhaps a pastor or a church leader, or if you're in education, maybe you're a Sunday school teacher or even a public education. It'd be a great book for you to get your hands on to get this wonderful overview and introduction to the whole field of apologetics. Let's give these away right now to callers 20, 21, and 22. If you call us at this number, 877-93-FAITH, that's 877-933-2484, we'll give you a copy of Chris Sinkinson's book, Christian Confidence. It's 1247. I'm Bill Meyer. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Back with more on apologetics in just a bit.
Hello, I'm David Jeremiah. Through my program, Turning Point, I have the privilege of teaching the unchanging Word of God to an ever-changing world. And it's that unchanging Word that transforms people's lives. We're privileged to partner together with Faith Radio in bringing that life-changing message into homes and cars and workplaces, not just so we'll know more about the Bible, but to help us connect faith to everyday life. Faith Radio provides the means for you to hear our programs every day, and we need your prayerful financial partnership, along with God's grace, to make it all possible. Changing lives through media is a team effort. So join the partnership today with your gift to Faith Radio, online at faithradionet.com, or by calling the Faith Line at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Together with God's help and yours, lives are changed. God bless you.
At the Center for Graduate Studies at Northwestern College, we help you chart your course with three words: believe, learn, master. Believe in God's power to lead in your life and in your education. Learn from expert professors who want you to succeed as much as you do. Master a discipline, and you'll get much more than a degree. You get a life change that never stops giving. Believe, learn, master. Find out more about Northwestern College graduate programs at nwc.edu.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. It's 12:51. It's the lunch hour here in the Upper Midwest. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us here on the Faith Radio Network. Bill Meyer with my special guest, Chris Sinkinson, all the way across the pond. I guess we're across the pond. You're in the right side of the pond. He's in Great Britain in New Forest, England. And, Chris, it's such a delight to have you. What time is it, by the way, in England right now?
Thank you. Well, it's coming up to, 10 to 7, 8 minutes to 7.
So all right. So has your sun gone down yet in New Forest?
The sun is just going down. Yeah, it's looking a little dark out there now. Mind you, your weather report earlier made me feel it's very balmy here, actually. We were nearly 60, I suppose, today. So should be great.
Yeah, it is definitely a cool weekend here in our area of the U.S. Chris is the author of Christian Confidence, a book on apologetics. It's an overview, an introduction. It's a historical treatise on the whole topic of apologetics. What makes a good argument, Chris, when it comes to defending the Christian faith?
I think a good argument has to be rational. It has to make sense. That means it's logical. And I spent some time looking in the book at what makes an argument logical. Logical principles really are like grammar in language. You know, it's how can a sentence be meaningful? How can it make sense? Now, of course, an argument could be logical, but actually not really be valid because maybe it's based on certain assumptions that are wrong. So not only should it be rational and reasonable, it should also be based on true evidence. Assumptions that are correct. So we should be able to point people to real evidence for what we believe. And the wonderful thing is, of course, that in the last 100 years, there is a wealth of evidence to confirm the reliability of the Bible. Not that we need necessarily all of that evidence, but more and more has come to light. During a century of skepticism, more has come to light to confirm the credibility of the Bible. So we might look to archaeology, we might look to the natural sciences, we might look to historical studies. And from each of these disciplines, there is just more evidence to help confirm the reliability of the Bible.
Let's take a few examples. I'm sorry, Chris. Give us a few examples of that, because I think that's one of the issues that many folks run up against when someone says, well, you can believe, you know, what you believe, but the Bible is a nice, you know, it's got some great moral principles, but, you know, the most of it's really just fiction or the miracles or myths. What do we have just in the last 100 years that has added to the reliability, the historical reliability of Scripture?
Well, of course, archaeology has only really been a discipline as we know it for about 100 years, and so it's quite ironic that during the last 100 years, as there's been skepticism over the Bible, archaeology has been producing an enormous amount of material evidence, what we read in the Bible. So going back 100 years ago, we would talk about the emergence of the evidence for the Hittite people. The Hittites, there is a people group in the book of Genesis and during the conquest period, and they seem to have vanished from history. So people wondered, who were these Hittites? Are they a mythological people? And yet in Turkey, the remains of the Hittite civilization began to emerge in the 1900s and confirmed what we read in the Bible. 2 hours from me, as I say, is London, and in London we can go to the British Museum and see many different finds that help to confirm and cast light on the accuracy of the biblical record. One example would be a little black obelisk. Now, of course, if any of you from the States who are stopping in London, just changing planes, you can pop in and have a look. It's completely free in the British Museum. And the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III is one of the first things you'll see. And it's the earliest picture of Israelites, actual picture of King Jehu and the Israelites bringing tribute to the Assyrian king Shalmaneser III. It's 2,841 years old, 841 BC, and it's an image that ties in with what we know about King Jehu in the Bible and shows he was a real person, the Israelites were real people, they fit with that time and place. Beyond that, you know, one of the areas of skepticism in recent years has been the existence of King David. Is King David a kind of King Arthur? Is he a mythological figure? Is he a figure created as a backstory for the Israelite history? Well, it's very interesting. In 1994, in Dan, which is one of the northern towns of Israel that's been excavated, formerly called Laish, in one of the walls, in rubble, if you like, was discovered sections of what was a memorial stela, a memorial inscription, which is dated to within 100 years of the time of King David and is the first direct literary reference to King David, to the House of David. And so since 1994, the argument that David was a mythological figure or a King Arthur is out of date. It's been overwhelmed by the evidence. Here is direct literary evidence for the existence of David from within 100 years, which, given how far back in the distant past these things happened, it is extraordinary how much we do have that helps confirm the record. I could multiply the examples, Bill.
I'm sure you could, and as an archaeologist with your background, it's fascinating. In fact, we were out of time for today, Chris, but I'd love to have you join us again in the future, and we can look at some of, again, the key arguments in apologetics and perhaps tying them to recent discoveries in both archaeology and science and literary research. If you're willing to do that, we'd love to have you on the program again, and we thank you so much for this great new book, Christian Confidence, from InterVarsity Press. Chris, may the Lord bless you and your work there in your church in New Forest, and thanks for being part of our program today. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciated it. Thank you.
Chris Sinkinson, all the way from New Forest, England, once again the author of this excellent new book, Christian Confidence. You can find out more about it at the InterVarsity Press website. I'm Bill Meyer. That wraps things up for our program for today. Coming up next, Susie Larson with the Saturday edition of Live the Promise, her guest Linda Dillo, discussing her book, What Is It Like to Be Married to Me? It's a great book for wives, for Christian women. So stick around for that here on the Faith Radio Network. I'll be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. You have a wonderful weekend, and keep it right here on the Faith Radio Network.